Coming to you from inside the Fanta-can at the bottom of the Marianas Trench, it's the Liberal Arts.
A podcast about post-grad life and the things we would study if someone were paying us.
Please, somebody pay us.
Do you have a fun fact for us?
I do have a fun fact for you. So this fact comes from my new job.
What is your new job? I mean, I know, but...
For the sake of the show, I'll pretend that you don't.
Yeah, exactly.
I have a new job working at a jewelry store. And so that's where my new fun fact has come from the other day.
Ooh.
My boss was talking with a customer about pocket watches.
Pocket watches are so cool.
They are so cool. Nowadays, when you think of good watches and clocks, where is one country you think of as being just at the top of their game?
Switzerland.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're so good that everyone wants to counterfeit them and make fake copies of their watches and clocks. Because people are willing to pay decent bit of money for a Swiss-made watch.
Yeah. Would you say they are willing to pay buku bucks?
Oh my god, please don't.
I don't know what that means.
It just means lots of money.
Okay. I was like, is this from a show I should have watched?
Science, you are constantly using slang that no one else knows. Like, it is a constant thing.
I can't help it.
I don't know where you got your vocabulary. I think it was a slightly different decade than me. And we're not that different in age.
Because of the high quality of Swiss clocks and watches, people like to pay a good bit of money for them because they know they're going to last. And people...
Stop
that. People also like to counterfeit them because they want to cash in on this.
Right.
Well, back in the day, in the mid-18, early 1900s, the best pocket watches in the world weren't Swiss. In fact, the Swiss pocket watches were actually not that great. The best watches in the world were American railroad-grade pocket watches. Used to keep time according to railroad schedules. They were pretty expensive. They would cost people like up to a month's worth of wages.
Wow.
And they were really accurate. So accurate that the Swiss were like, we need to get in on this, and started making fake American pocket watches.
No.
That's amazing!
Oh my gosh.
I love it.
So in 1871, Congress was like, this is getting out of hand. And they passed a law that said every watch has to have its country of origin on it somewhere.
Watch. Couldn't the Swiss just stamp in U.S. on theirs? Like, that's not going to stop counterfeiting.
They would have had to, if the Swiss wanted to sell their watches in America, they would have had to export them to America. They would have been inspected.
Oh, you're saying that the Swiss counterfeited watches for sale here?
For probably anywhere, but they would have sold them here, too.
Okay.
So, any watches...
So, if you're importing watches and they say U.S. of A, then you're wrong. So I guess that's a way to
the law is actually still in effect. So if you have a watch that was made outside the U.S., it's going to be stamped with its country of origin on it somewhere.
Really?
I distinctly remember having a plasticky McDonald's watch that said made in Taiwan.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I think I have a watch made in China.
Mm-hmm. But even, you know, the high quality like German watches or something like that, they're all going to have their country of origin on them somewhere. And apparently the Swiss got really creative with trying to get around this law initially. Before they caught up to American manufacturing standards, they would do things like hide the word Swiss somewhere in the filigree on the watch. Or...
What? That's perfect.
Just try to make it unnoticeable so people didn't realize what they were buying. But
I love that.
Yeah. And so that's something that I've learned, and I thought it was really fun.
That's hilarious.
That, you know, once that's upon amazing. A time, the Swiss used to counterfeit American watches.
I love it.
So, Science, do you have a colloquium you would like to share with us today?
Oh, boy, do I.
I am very excited for your colloquium this time.
I am too. All right, so this colloquium is a primer on poisons.
Woohoo!
Yes. I have wanted to hear you talk about this for, like, the past several years. You did, like, a presentation in undergrad, and I remember you studying for it, and then I obviously wasn't in it because I wasn't in any science classes with you. I've been waiting for this.
Yeah, and oh, you did man. The thing for us for the venue, but other oh, than that, really, yes. You keep alluding to poison and then not actually discussing it. So.
Do well, tell.
The reason that I like poisons so much is that it's what first got me interested in chemistry as a career. So, like, when I was in high school, I found a book called The Poisoner's Handbook, which was not a recipe book.
Man!
It's actually a book about the birth of forensic science in New York City in the 1920s.
Hmm.
And it's excellent. It's a very good book. It's by Deborah Bloom. I cannot recommend it enough. It's not overly, like, chemistry heavy, but it definitely puts chemistry at the center stage. And reading that book in high school, I was like, hey, I like this a lot. And hey, I'm also good at chemistry. Why not get a job where I can actually make money?
You thought you were going to say get a job making poisons for a little bit. I was like, well.
That might be illegal. It's very hard to say.
There are some legitimate uses for poison.
Oh, yeah, there are lots. Guys, could you just define for me real quick what you think a poison is?
Oh, you goodness. Use it to kill things.
It's a chemical substance that, if consumed, kills you.
Y'all are not far off.
Yes!
So yeah,
we're
poison
so good
is
at
not,
chemistry.
It's not a very scientific definition. It just means something that is... that disrupts the chemical reactions in your body.
Hmm.
Usually.
Oh god. No, anything with a usually. It's like that little asterisk. Except when it's not.
Yeah, well, poison is a very general term for a lot of blanket terms. So I'm gonna define some other things real quick.
Okay.
First of all, do you guys know the difference between a poison and a venom?
No.
A venom is something that occurs within a living creature, and it kills you, and a poison doesn't, and it kills you.
I know, no, I think it's like, if you eat, you can eat something poisonous, or you can be bitten by something venomous.
That is true, although I will add that venoms are injected.
Okay.
Basically. They are poisons that are injected. All venoms are poisons, not all poisons are venoms.
Okay.
So you can swallow snake venom and it's not going to give you anything more than just, like, heartburn.
What?
What? Seriously?
Yeah, because, yeah, no, you don't, it doesn't absorb into your body. You don't digest it. Like, it just passes right through.
What? Is it because of, what? Does it have to be in your blood in order to take effect?
It does have to be in your blood. So, yeah, you can straight up swallow snake venom and not be harmed. Unfortunately, a lot of people don't know that, so they'll be like, oh, I drink snake venom, I'm immune, and then they get bit by a snake.
They think they're immune. I'm sorry.
People drink snake venom.
Yeah, to build their immunity to snake venom. It doesn't work, though, because venom is injected.
Does it?
Not swallowed.
I mean, does it taste bad?
I don't know.
Where do they get it?
I never asked.
From snakes.
If any of our listeners know how snake venom tastes.
All I'm thinking of right now is in Holes when she put snake venom on her fingernails.
Yeah, it's something like that. All right, here's another question for you. Do you know the difference between a poison and a toxin?
Oh, no, not at all.
There's a difference.
Are all poisons toxinous, but not all toxins poisons?
Actually, yeah.
Yes! I was good at chemistry.
No, Oh, I messed up. It's the other way around.
No! So wait, say the correct one.
All toxins are poisonous, but not all poisons are toxins.
Okay, so what's a toxin?
A toxin is just something that is bad for you that is created within another living organism.
Okay.
So technically, venoms are also toxins.
Okay, so a non-organic poison is not toxins-ness?
Right, so a non-organic thing would be like cadmium. Cadmium is a metal. It is not created by a living thing. It's like just a metal. But if it dissolves in water or you swallow it, it will kill you. It is poisonous, but it is not toxic, nor really? Is it a venom.
Okay. I've always thought of toxic as how to describe that kind of thing. So is there like a specific word for non-organic poison?
I mean, poison.
Okay.
All the trucks, like the chemical trucks that we see on the road that will say toxic gas are actually wrong.
It's not that they're wrong. Toxic is not a toxin. Toxic just means bad for you. I don't know. It's a nomenclature thing. Listen, scientific nomenclature, for the most part, is just, oh, that sounds about right.
So when people say toxic waste, is that an organic reference?
No, it means that it is bad for you.
Okay.
That's all it means. Because cool. A lot of times toxic waste can be byproducts of natural processes.
Right.
But a lot of times it's also like radioactive waste.
That's what I was thinking.
Although, if it's radioactive, it will be labeled radioactive waste.
Right. Okay.
So, and that's not technically a toxin.
It's just bad.
Oh!
It's just bad for you. So, I will also say, as a caveat before I go into any of this stuff I'm about to talk to you about, that almost anything can be poisonous if you do it wrong.
I thought, like, for a second, I thought your caveat was going to be like, don't try this at home. So, yeah, isn't it like water can kill you if you drink too much, that kind of thing?
Oh, yeah. Water can burst your stomach. It doesn't change a chemical process in your body, but it kills you all the same.
Is, like, smoke inhalation poisonous, or is that not a poison?
I guess that could be considered poisonous, although poisons are also usually ingested, like, by your mouth.
I mean, smoke inhalation can be by your mouth.
That's, yes, but it goes into your lungs and not your stomach.
We're getting to it.
Poisons are things that end up in your stomach, specifically.
Usually. Oh. Listen, again with the nomenclature. We could spend all day on this.
Sorry, please continue to what you were going to say.
So should we talk about some history?
Yes.
Of course.
Poisons?
Always.
Okay, the history of poison starts like this. We've always been really good at killing ourselves and each other with chemicals. Just for a long time. We've known about a lot of natural poisons for a while. We didn't necessarily know what they were, but things like
hemlock,
the mushrooms,
cyanide, strychnine. They've always been around. It's like, oh, you eat the bark of that tree, you're gonna die. Don't eat the bark of that tree. So, but we've also been really good at utilizing poisons for a long time. Like, okay, so we know a lot about natural poisons from plants and things. And then snakes. Snakes are the obvious one. And spiders, I suppose, do venom.
Well, let's not talk about obvious spiders. Poisons.
There's also poison from dart frogs and certain kinds of toads.
Yeah.
There are poisons from certain kinds of bugs as well. Oh, gosh. I have a list here of, like, people groups who have used poison arrows.
From dart frogs.
Yeah, so the poison dart frogs are most often used by, like, 3 or 4 people groups in Colombia. I say used. That's cool. I don't know if they're currently in use or if there's, like, restrictions on that. I do know, and I have seen photos of signs in the Colombian jungle that say, do not lick the frogs.
In case you were going to.
Wow, there goes my night's plans.
Do you guys want me to talk about poison arrows throughout history?
Yes, please.
So, most people groups use plants. In, like, Japan, Kyrgyzstan, and China, they use a plant from the buttercup family for poison arrows.
Okay.
In Assam and Burma and Malaysia, there's a tree that is in, like, the mulberry breadfruit family that they use for poison arrows.
Huh.
There is, in the Kalahari, which is in Botswana and Namibia, there's a beetle that the people groups there, like, just squeeze out onto arrows.
Whoa.
Ew.
They squeeze out the larva.
Ew.
It's disgusting. North American natives used golden poppy. In sub-Saharan Africa, in Togo and Cameroon, they use plants. The Caribs of the Caribbean use plants. There is even one, I found one reference to a group in the South Pacific that, like, let a dead body just fester and drip for a while. And they dip the arrows in the drippings.
No.
Which means poison by tetanus, guys. What a way to go. Okay, so these are ways that we've killed people with poison arrows. But of course, that is not the sum total of our knowledge about poisons. The ancient Egyptians wrote about poisons in their natural history. It's some of the oldest medical texts that we have. There have been poisons known in India and Greece for a long time. But the first specifically, like, scientific references to poisons all go back to King Mithridates VI of Pontus.
What? Yes. One, where is that? Two, who is that?
Pontus is, it's south of the Black Sea.
Okay.
Right? It's,
Mithridates, sorry, I'm sitting here trying to remember. I know this name, and I'm trying to remember who he was. Continue.
Well, there were six of them.
Okay. Not helping.
At least. Typical. So, yeah, no, he was a, like, Greco kind of guy. I don't know. I don't think Pontus is technically Greek, but it's kind of that area.
Okay.
They fought the Romans. They were really big on fighting the Romans. They loved fighting those
Many
Romans.
Many people were...
He lived about like 100 to 60 or so BC.
Okay.
And he was, I saw one book reference him as the first toxicologist.
Ooh.
So apparently people have tried to kill him so often that he spent a bunch of his time trying to find an ultimate antidote.
Ooh.
Like, people tried to, like, people killed, okay, they killed his dad when he was a teenager with poison.
Aww.
His mom tried to kill one of his brothers with poison. It was kind of a constant in his life, so he's like, I need to build up my immunity to this and find an antidote. So he would, first of all, poison himself on the regular to try and build up an immunity to poisons, which didn't, it seemed, we'll talk about it, whether or not that worked later. But he also did experiments to see... Yes?
I looked it up. Pontus is in what is now northeastern Turkey.
Ah, thank you. Look at that.
Wait,
it's Turkey again.
It's in Turkey?
It's in Turkey. Thank you for that. Mm-hmm. Looking that up. So he did experiments on prisoners who were condemned to die.
Mm-hmm.
To see, like, to poison them and then try antidotes on them to see if they worked.
Good grief.
And they say that he created a surefire antidote for all poison, and they called it Mithridatium because they were not too creative.
That's awesome. Do we know what it was?
Well, depending on who you read, it had 36, 54, or 4 ingredients.
Wow.
Wow.
They all list different recipes. None of them seem like they would be particularly effective. Like, the one that had 4 ingredients was, like, figs, walnuts, pinch of salt.
Okay. I was half expecting this to be, like, that kind of thing, and half expecting it to be, like, you know, mandrake crushed by moonlight type of, you know?
Well, Pliny the Elder and Cassius Dio weren't too specific about the manner in which they were made, although some of the measurements are, like, extremely, like, specific, like, extremely scientific and narrowed down measurements.
Wow, like what?
So, things like anise and, safflower mm-hmm. oil and, like, there was a bunch of stuff. Cloves.
Safflower okay. oil?
Yeah.
I have that in my kitchen right now. I don't think I'm gonna use it as, like, poison
antidote.
Well, that's the thing, is these ingredients were all thought by the science of the time to be helpful. Most of them were, like, aromatic. They smelled great. Which, again, the science of the time said, if the good smell displaces the bad smell, then that means the good stuff has displaced the bad stuff, and
right.
you're cured.
So that's how that works.
You can't
that
be
is
sick,
definitely
you smell fine.
Just Lysol it up over here. We're good.
Yeah.
We're good.
So, the scientific, you know, alacrity of the claim for an antidote for all poison is dubious, especially because, you know, the way that strychnine poisons you is very different than the way arsenic poisons you.
Right.
So, we don't know for sure. But we do know that there are a few accounts of Mithridates trying to poison himself when he's older because he wants to die. Cassius Dio said that when he was old, he was put in a position where it was face capture or die. So he poisoned his daughters and his wife, and he tried to poison himself. I know. It was to avoid capture. They would have been... It was an honor thing.
Right.
I don't agree with it. I understand. And he tried to poison himself, but he couldn't die because his immunity was just too good.
No. Right. I was going to ask, the important question is, was he killed by poison in the end?
No, he was not. As far as we know, he was stabbed, either by his own hand or by the hand of someone he trusted.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, the question is, the real question that I have is, if Mithridates is said to have done this, is it also possible to build up an immunity to iocane powder?
Is iocane powder real, Hannah?
It is not real.
Oh, I feel so lied to.
Well, okay, if it makes you feel better, I thought Florin and Gilder were real places.
Oh, Hannah.
Okay, so do we want to talk about different kinds of poisons?
Yes, please.
I have split the kinds of poisons we're talking to into three groups. Metals, alkaloids, and other.
What's an alkaloid?
You'll see.
Ooh.
So, let's start with metals. So, you need some metals. You need iron especially. Iron helps your blood carry oxygen to the rest of your body.
That seems important.
So you need that, yes. You need trace amounts of things like potassium and sodium. You need...
potassium is a metal?
Yeah.
I didn't actually know that.
I thought you got potassium from potatoes.
I thought you got it from, like, bananas.
You do.
And it's a metal?
It's ionic in... Listen. Oh, we should talk about ions, I guess, before we do anything else. So... Metals can exist as chunks of metal. We know this.
Yes.
But metals can also exist as something called ions. So when a metal gives up some of its electrons in order to find, like, a more stable energy state, then we call it an ion.
Right.
You see them written as things like Fe2+. That is iron 2+.
Okay.
Or iron 2. Okay.
Iron 2, the sequel to iron.
What's funny is there's not an iron 1, but there is an iron 3 and 4.
It's like Star Wars.
Exactly. So when people freak out about mercury, especially in things like vaccines, there is an ion of mercury that will definitely kill you very quickly.
Which one?
And inevitably. I'm going to say Mercury 1+.
Okay.
I believe that's correct. And then there is a mercury ion that is actually harmless and won't hurt you at all. And that's why we use it in vaccines. Because it's a great preservative. And I believe that is Mercury 3+.
Cool.
And they don't change very easily. Otherwise, we wouldn't put them in vaccines.
Right.
So it can't just randomly lose an ion.
Well, it would have to lose 2 more electrons, and it doesn't do that very easily because it's bound up with a bunch of other stuff.
Did I say lose an ion? I apologize.
Well, I'm not going to judge you for not getting these scientific terms that I just introduced to you correct. I mean,
but I feel like I probably should know the difference between ion and electron.
I know that I have no mathematic or scientific knowledge. I accept my ignorance of these things.
So, all right, so you do need some metals in your body, and you need some metal ions in your body. But some metal ions, especially things like cadmium or mercury, are very, very bad for you. The things that they tend to do, they tend to take the place of things that you actually need. So, like, mercury will hop into a place where potassium's supposed to be, and because mercury is not potassium, it's very hard to get out, and suddenly you can't absorb potassium anymore, and you die.
Oh, dear.
Or, like, radium, if you, like, swallow radium.
That sounds like a bad idea, just in general.
It's a very bad idea. People used to do it, though. Like, you know those glow-in-the-dark watches? They were invented in the 20s, right?
Okay.
Well, the way that they used to make glow-in-the-dark watches was by painting the clock faces with radium.
Ooh.
And
did people lick their watches?
Oh, they didn't lick the watches, but the women, and they were mostly women, who painted the clock dials would sharpen the tips of their brushes with their mouths.
Ooh. No, 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 no.
Yes.
Did they all die?
Yeah, actually, they did, of terrible cancers for the most part. Do you know why?
Why?
Because they licked radium? Because
your body thinks that radium looks a lot like calcium, and it replaces the calcium in your bones.
No!
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's the worst.
And on top of that, it's radioactive, yeah, so poison, that plus cancer.
Poison radioactive bones?
Yes.
No.
Oh.
It's the worst. It is terrible.
That sounds like something from, like, you know, some fantasy thriller, sci-fi, fight the skeletons.
Poison radioactive bones.
Yeah, poison radioactive skeletons.
Yeah, basically.
Dang, son.
Apparently, if you take a Geiger counter to the places where these women are buried, it still goes off.
Oh my gosh. Oh.
Yeah. Ow. That is the apocryphal knowledge. I have not seen, like, I've not seen anyone who's actually gone and done it. I mean, I just heard that that's what happened.
There's still a trail of radioactive poop leading to the Pacific, so it's possible.
True. We have
Mercury is not this. Mercury is not radioactive. It's very important to me that you know that Mercury is not radioactive.
I'm betting that the thing called radon is, though.
Was it Mercury radon that was in those pills?
Yes, it was.
Okay, sorry, I couldn't remember the ingredient. All I could think was...
Hopefully it was the
Mercury. You don't track mercury with a Geiger counter. You track it with, like, a soil sample.
Okay.
Cool.
Yeah. Okay, so metal poison is tough to deal with because, you know, sometimes it kills you very quickly and horribly, like mercury or cadmium. But sometimes it collects in your body and it's very hard to get rid of except by chelation therapy, which is where they take a very awful, grabby sort of chemical and they put it in your body and it kind of just grabs whatever ions it can find. It's kind of like chemotherapy in that it is ingesting poison because the alternative is worse.
Jeez.
Yeah.
My father tried a natural supplement that was supposed to do a natural chelation therapy. Someone told him it was a good idea.
How'd that work out for him?
It did not. He ended up in the hospital.
Oh my gosh.
Yikes.
Was he okay?
He was fine. It just really weakened his body.
Yeah.
Because somebody told him he was gonna, you're gonna detox your system with this stuff.
Well, you could tell them that metallic poisons are not toxins.
Hey.
Hey. The problem is that if this chelation therapy grabs onto the bad ions in your system, then it's also gonna grab onto the good ions. The chelation cannot tell the difference.
So, like, calcium and stuff.
Yes. Can I tell you guys about arsenic?
Yes,
yes, please.
Please.
I've been waiting for the arsenic and cyanide to come out, basically.
Oh, yes. All right, so I'm going to talk about two metallic poisons in particular, arsenic and lead. So arsenic is, it's so infamous that, like, so in medieval Europe, arsenic was known as inheritance powder. Because
what?
Yeah.
No.
It's like, wow, granddad sure is hanging around, isn't he? Is he going to give up the wealth slash throne anytime
How
soon?
How did that not make it into Game of Thrones?
It's about
oh
it, right?
Gosh.
So arsenic is also a metal, but when they say powder, they're talking about arsenic trioxide, which is arsenic and three oxygens. It is, yeah, it's AS2O3, I believe, or ASO3, which
those letters
like
mean
plus.
Things.
Yeah, okay. Arsenic trioxide is actually a byproduct of silver and gold mining. Like, when you're heating up silver and gold ore, arsenic trioxide tends to, like, dust powder out.
Huh.
And you can collect it and poison people with it. Or, you know, whatever.
I bet that that's what they did.
They did, in fact. You know, elemental arsenic is not great for you, but arsenic trioxide is usually... it's worse. So, you swallow it, and it keeps you from being able to use B12, like vitamin B12.
Ooh.
It also makes your cells start to produce hydrogen peroxide.
Bad,
which,
bad, bad.
Yeah, not good for you.
No.
How quickly does arsenic kill you?
It depends on how much you have. If you... okay, so there was one instance in the book, The Poisoner's Handbook. This man took an apple and rubbed arsenic trioxide into it.
Why?
And gave it to his... and gave it to his wife. He wanted to kill his wife.
That is the worst.
Yeah, it is the worst. So if it kills you, if it's gonna kill you quickly, though, you'll be able to taste it. It tastes metallic. It's gross.
Don't eat metallic apples. Check.
Got it, yes. But if it's in a low enough dose that you can't taste it, then it's going to do, like, it's going to collect in your body. Your skin will start to get, like, dark patches and feel thicker. It'll cause heart problems. You'll get cancer. It's not good. Actually, in Bangladesh, they have a serious problem with arsenic in the water supply. Yeah, and back in Arkansas, you know, they had those signs by the springs in the park where it was like, don't drink this water, not good for you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's because it was full of arsenic.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah. Dang. People used to bathe there for a vacation.
Yeah.
Isn't that great?
That's, ugh.
Can arsenic be absorbed, like, through the skin, though?
I mean, if you rub enough on there, yeah, but, like, it's going to be much more effective if you eat it.
Okay.
You can't, like, stick your hand in the water and you're arsenic poisoned.
I just,
like,
you said bathing, so.
Oh, well, I mean, if you're putting your whole body in there and soaking for a while, then yes, some arsenic will get in your body. Okay. But, like, just touching the spring wouldn't do it for you.
Okay.
And then there's lead. Lead's not good for you.
No, especially not when it comes at high speed.
Very true. When you are shot with lead, it is... very acute poisoning.
So acute, it doesn't even have a chance to poison you.
Well, there is some stuff in which lead poison is a euphemism for being shot to death.
So. Okay, well, this one is not a euphemism. I'm literally talking about lead poisoning. lead is very, very bad. Unfortunately, it's also very, very useful, so it's in a lot of stuff. Everybody talks about kids who eat paint chips getting lead poisoning. That's because lead was used to make paint colors more vibrant, and it worked, except that it's also full of lead, and then you lick it, and then the lead collects on your neurons, and you have a hard time developing proper brain function as you grow up.
Don't lick the walls.
So, do not lick the walls, either.
Well, also, like, paintings. I once got to go to a... Oh, was it Rembrandt Museum, in which they did a demonstration about making pigments, and the there was a couple, they were like, we cannot demonstrate this to you, and one of them was white, because he used white lead.
Yes, that's true.
They had pictures of, like, this is what it looks like to make white lead. We're not doing it.
Yeah, there's also a red that is, lead-based.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So too much lead affects organ function, nervous system functions. It's especially bad for children who are still developing. The thing that makes it so bad for your brain, because usually these poisons don't affect your brain. They don't cross the blood-brain barrier, which is basically your brain's way of protecting itself from acute poison.
Okay.
Except your brain, blood-brain barrier thinks that lead is calcium, and it just kind of sallies on through.
No. Brain.
Yeah. This is... actually been a big problem, I'm sure you've heard about it, in Flint, Michigan.
Yeah, I have heard about it.
Yeah. A lot of cities have lead pipes and lead soldering on pipes, right?
Was that, like, because we didn't used to know it was bad or something?
Basically, yeah. They're just very old. People, I think it was in the 60s that the use of lead pipes was banned. But there are cities that are older than the 60s, shockingly.
I know.
Usually, lead pipes aren't too much of a problem because most drinking water supplies have phosphates added to them. Now, phosphates, that's another ion, it's made of phosphorus and oxygen. It kind of coats the lead so that it doesn't dissolve into the water and you can't get it into drinking water.
Oh.
Okay? So what happened in Flint was Flint's city decided to stop using Detroit's water supply and start using a water supply from Lake Erie. Which was a pretty good idea, except that the pipeline from Lake Erie was not built in time. So, instead of saying, hey, Detroit, can we keep using your water for a while? They're like, well, we have a river. We have the Flint River. Let's just use the Flint River.
That's such a bad idea.
Well, it wouldn't have been a bad idea, except that in creating this new water usage infrastructure... they decided that it wasn't worthwhile to add phosphates to the water. They're like, it's going to cost us $40 a day. You know, we might as well just skip it. And the EPA was like, no, you really shouldn't do that. And they're like, no, it'll be fine.
And it wasn't.
It was not, because without those phosphates, the coating on the lead pipes and the lead soldering started to dissolve, which meant the lead started to dissolve into the water. There are other problems, too. That's not the only problem. The discoloration comes from rust, from steel pipes. There are pH problems that are causing bacterial infections as well.
So are they filtering? Basically, what you're saying is that they've not filtered this water at all.
Well, that's the thing, is they have filtered it. The problem is just filtering it isn't enough. You gotta add stuff back in that you took out. Otherwise, you're filtering it and then putting it through something else that is also dirty.
Ugh.
Yeah. So, recently Flint was like, hey, Detroit, can we have the water supply back? And Detroit obliged. So they do have the water supply back from Detroit. They are adding phosphates back into the water, but it's going to take a while to fix the damage, to replace that coating on the lead pipes. You know, they really should replace the pipes, but that's even more expensive. Right. And, yeah. So things will get better, but not for a little while, unfortunately.
And the side effects of that are permanent?
Yes, unfortunately so. Lead collects in your body, and there's not much you can do about it except chelation therapy, which is...
Also again, bad for you.
It's not good for you, and it's very expensive. You know, a lot like chemotherapy, so... Mm.
Do you want to learn a funner fact about lead?
Oh, sure.
In the movie, Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King, the prop miniature of Grond, the great battering ram brought against the gates of Minas Tirith, was carved from soft lead. And the people who made it had to do it very slowly with lots of gloves, and they could only work for certain amounts of time every day so that they didn't get too much lead in them or on them or in their lungs. It was a huge problem. I mean, it was a miniature, but it was still huge and extremely detailed. And I mean, to be honest, there's only a few shots of it in the film, but they put a lot of work, and it's so basically that giant wolf burning battering ram is also extremely poisonous.
Wow. That is a very fun fact.
Thank you. Okay, I'm sorry, I interrupted you, though. You were going to tell us other...
Cyanide, actually.
Cyanide, yay. I know about cyanide.
Yes, this is part one of my other... It's kind of halfway between alkaloids and metals because it's a very simple chemical. So, cyanide is also an ion.
But not a metal?
Not a metal. It's made of one carbon and one nitrogen, and it's got an electric charge. It's got, like, an extra electron hanging out.
Okay.
It is, unlike metal ions, it's a negative ion.
Okay.
And it occurs pretty commonly in nature, actually. It's a part of cyanic salts, or as cyanic acid.
Yes, cyanic acid is what I know things about.
Apple seeds.
That is. Yeah, actually, it's apple seeds, apricot pits, and peach pits. By the way, if you ever see a bag of apricot pits meant for snacking, don't eat them!
That sounds awful.
Wait.
Yeah, no, it's the worst idea. I've seen them. They exist. What kind of stupid granola crap is this? Why are you feeding people cyanide? Why are you doing that?
I mean, I have definitely eaten that acid before, because I have definitely eaten apple seeds.
Yes. Well, that's the thing about cyanide. The amounts in apple seeds, peach pits, and apricot pits, they're very, very small amounts. Yeah. But if you eat a peach pit...
That's a terrible idea.
They don't
if
even
you snack on them regularly...
Good.
No, they don't.
I was fussing at my dad the other day because he was putting an entire apple, including the core, into his smoothie, and I was like, no,
I eat apple cores all the time.
A little bit of apple seed is not going to hurt you. If you eat several pounds of apple seeds, that is, you're going to die of cyanide poisoning, and also you're going to be really, really full.
No, but almost every time I eat an apple, I eat the whole thing.
Yeah, it's not going to harm you too much. You actually metabolize cyanide pretty regularly because it is a pretty common byproduct of, you know, natural fruits and things that we eat. However, if you have too much cyanide, then your blood thinks that it's oxygen.
Ooh.
Okay.
No.
So the hemoglobin in your blood, it's made of an iron and then a big organic molecule around that iron, and it grabs onto oxygen and it takes it places, right?
Right.
Well, okay, if you eat cyanide, then your hemoglobin grabs onto the cyanide, and then it can't let go of the cyanide, and then you stop being able to absorb oxygen.
That is not
good. So, like, you can keep breathing and suffocate to death?
Yeah.
That's terrifying.
That's awful. And The marker, the marker of cyanide poisoning is this cherry red blood.
Oh, because it doesn't have oxygen. It has oxygen.
Exactly.
Wow. So how do you cure someone of cyanide? Is there like an antidote?
There are, yeah. I don't know what they are.
Oh, okay.
Acute cyanide toxicity will kill you too fast to cure.
Right.
But again, if you have a little bit over time, then your body just kind of just filters it out. It's not like metal poison. It doesn't collect in your body. Uh-huh. I mean, eventually it will harm you, but like apple seeds when you eat apples is not going to kill you.
Okay, good.
I have heard that cyanide or cyanic acid or whatever is also in bamboo.
Yes, and that is
so
true.
So like pandas eat a lot of it and they don't die.
Yeah, some animals have digestive processes that'll just take care of cyanide.
Pandas are magic. That's what you meant to
say. Pandas are magic.
Yes, thank you. That so was like friendship. The one cyanide fact I knew is that pandas eat it.
I love it. So let's talk about alkaloids.
Yes, what is that?
An alkaloid is another one of those science terms that someone came up with because it made sense at the time.
Oh no. Oh no.
So alkaloids refer to a set of chemicals that are bitter. They are produced by living things, mostly plants, but also some bugs and toads. And structurally it means they have at least one ring of carbon, probably more.
Wait, so this, there's
nitrogen in there somewhere. Because cyanide is one carbon and one nitrogen.
As opposed to...
a bunch of carbons and a nitrogen.
Oh, okay.
Huh. Yeah, if you see chemical structures that have, like, hexagons in them...
Yeah.
That's what I mean when I say a ring of carbon. Those hexagons, it's a carbon at every corner.
Okay. Is that, like, really common?
Pretty much, yeah. It's in, I mean, it's in our DNA. It is in...
Really?
Yeah, the proteins that we have in our bodies.
Do we have poison in our DNA, Hannah?
Hey. Alkaloids are not in our DNA. I'm talking about rings of carbon.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fine.
It's just a really stable chemical structure.
Okay.
Okay, so alkaloids include things like caffeine.
Oh, no.
Yeah, or theobromine, which is the thing that is like caffeine in chocolate.
Ooh, so in other words, I just ate some.
Yeah, you did. It includes opiates like codeine and morphine. It includes anti-malarial drugs like quinine. It includes anti-asthma drugs like ephedrine.
Wow.
So, like, yeah, it's a very broad chemical category, and it's not very, like, precise scientifically. It also includes things like strychnine or scopolamine, which will give you some really weird birth defects. Nicotine, cocaine, those are also alkaloids.
Wow.
There's one called tubicurarine, which is the one that we talked about earlier from poison arrows.
Oh.
So also an alkaloid from a plant. So plants produce them because they tend to deter predators and, like, act as mild pesticides.
Okay.
It actually might be a problem because we have a lot of nicotine-based pesticides that are really good because they're biodegradable, unlike a lot of, like, nasty pesticides. But they may be contributing to the bee problem.
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
So we don't know for sure. It's very difficult to track what exactly is causing the problem, but there are some links that suggest nicotine-based pesticides. So great for plants, not great for bees, probably. Which, maybe.
I mean, in the long run, anything not great for bees is not great for plants.
No.
That's true. That's very true. Almost all... alkaloids have physical effects on you. Many we use for medicine. They're just variations on ones found in nature anyway. But my favorite ones are the poisons.
I was gonna say my favorite ones are the chocolates, so... I don't know what's wrong with you.
So there's strychnine, right?
Yes.
It causes convulsions, asphyxia, and death.
This is the good part we're all waiting for.
Oh, yes. It has been known for a long time. People in ancient India, Sri Lanka, and Indonesia wrote about strychnine. It's from a kind of tree. It's also the first alkaloid that was ever isolated. It was isolated in 1753 by Carl Linnaeus.
I'm sorry, what does isolated mean?
Isolated means that they took the plant that it's from, and they did a bunch of chemistry stuff to it until all they had was strychnine, like crystals of strychnine.
Oh, wow, okay.
Yeah, a pure chemical. So strychnine was classically used as a pesticide, although some people were like, you know what? It's just like caffeine. It'll make me real, you know, real hyped up. So people like would use it as like a juice, like they would juice with strychnine for sports. And then there's mandrake, and that's a weird one.
Is mandrake poisonous? Mandrake's,
it's poisonous.
It's got a lot of alkaloid poisons in there, yeah.
Whoa.
It is also hallucinogenic and narcotic as well. Causes blurred vision, dilation of your pupils, it'll mess up your stomach, it makes gives you tachycardia, which is when your heart beats too fast. Sometimes it asphyxiates you.
Wow.
It's got a very weird mythos built around it, though.
Yeah.
There's like the legend that if you pull it out of the ground, it'll scream at you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Which is referenced, of course, in Harry Potter.
Yep.
People used to, like, tie mandrake roots to animals so that the animals would pull it out to keep the mandrake from screaming.
I've heard of, like, mandrake being used as, like, a cure-all for, like, it makes you better type of thing.
And there was a lot of thought that went into that. It's very closely connected to fertility as well.
Okay.
It's actually in the Bible.
Really?
Yeah.
Yes, there
is. Is it in Song of Solomon?
No.
It is, but it's also... Now that you mention it. It is mentioned twice in the Bible, once in Song of Solomon and once in Genesis. Jacob loves Rachel more. Leah says, hey, I will trade you your night with Jacob for this mandrake root, since you can't have any babies. And the implication being is that the mandrake is going to help her have children.
Okay.
Which Rachel makes the trade and still does not have children for quite some time.
So it didn't help.
It did not help. It's also, like, referenced a lot in witchcraft, like, and I'm talking both, like, Wicca witchcraft and, like, old school witchcraft. I found a recipe from a medieval manuscript about if you really want to have a little friend, like a little homunculus friend, then you take a little bit of mandrake and you bury it somewhere.
This is the worst idea.
It's very bad.
This is the worst idea.
Apparently you have a little mandrake homunculus.
No.
Little mandrake boy.
No. Why would you want that? Oh, no.
Just
no,
walk
no.
around screaming at you?
Listen, I'm not a witch. I don't know.
No. Actually, you know what's really funny? Okay, this is going to sound really random. I took one of those stupid little personality tests the other day, the kind you find on Facebook, and it was like... It based on your answers to questions, it matched you to a random card. Well, not random, but like to a weird card from Magic the Gathering. And the one I got was like, I don't remember what it was. It was like irritating homunculus or something. And it looked like this little bitty kind of creature that was like yelling. So it looked kind of like a little mandrake boy. I'm going to have to go find, because like someone who plays Magic is going to listen to this and going to be really annoyed with me.
We should definitely put that on the vlog. Bless. Okay, so some other famous alkaloid poisons are belladonna, which is also known as deadly nightshade. It is psychoactive. It is used as an aphrodisiac and a hallucinogen. It causes narcosis and eventually paralysis and death.
These are all... Wow.
Yeah. Every part of a belladonna plant is poisonous. All of it. Flowers, roots, stalks... especially the leaves.
Is it all the same poison? Or like...
No, they're different levels. The roots are the most poisonous part, depending on what species of belladonna you're looking at. But people actually take the berries and use them as psychoactives and aphrodisiacs. Like two or three at a time. Well,
like they do it on purpose?
Yeah. Or even like 5 or 10. More than that almost certainly will kill you. 2 or 3 if you're a child. And then there's hemlock.
Socrates.
I saved it for last in the alkaloid poisons because I knew that you would be interested in it.
Thank you.
Hemlock is very, very deadly. It's more deadly than belladonna. It's the most deadly plant we've talked about yet.
Really?
In very small doses, it causes respiratory failure and death.
Hmm.
Well, apparently your feet and arms get pretty heavy first.
Yes. Thank you, Socrates. And that's true. It causes you to be paralyzed. It's very bad. Incidentally, intubate someone, then they will suffer real bad for about 2 to 4 days.
Dang.
day.
And then you will have metabolized all of the hemlock, and it will be out of your system.
Oh.
And you'll wow. and you'll live.
Well, that's good to know.
So yeah. does it just close up your airways, or?
Yeah, it well, it causes them to be paralyzed so that they don't work anymore.
Oh, wow, dang. That's yeah. terrifying.
Yes. So that's hemlock. Those are alkaloid poisons. And then there's mushrooms. This is part two of other.
Right.
This is my don't try this at home, kids. Don't eat random mushrooms. Just don't do it.
No.
Don't. You can't tell the difference between good mushrooms and poison mushrooms unless you're an expert. If you're an expert, eat all the mushrooms you like. But if you're not, don't just go eating mushrooms. So I want to talk about two of the five most deadly mushrooms that you can eat.
Okay.
They are called Deadly Nightcap and Destroying Angel.
Ooh, oh. I like people whoever
who
named
name
them.
Mushrooms. Yeah, mm. people who name mushrooms are rad as heck. So both of these mushrooms have a poison called alpha amanitin.
Okay.
Which will give you. Okay, so say that you ate a destroying angel, which is the coolest thing I'm going to say today.
Yeah.
About 24 hours after you ate that destroying angel, you would have really bad stomach upset, diarrhea, probably vomiting too. And then you'd feel a lot better for like 4 days. And then you'd die.
Oh, this is scary.
Yes.
How would you die?
Liver failure.
Ooh.
It shreds your liver. Even people who survive this often have to get liver replacements.
Dang.
Yeah, it just messes you right up. So.
But people have survived?
People have survived.
Don't do
not
it, though.
Easily. Don't do it.
Don't
just
lick the don't. Mushrooms.
Don't lick the mushrooms, don't lick the walls, don't lick the frogs. Don't do
don't
it.
Don't lick things, people.
Don't lick anything ever.
Except ice cream.
Ice cream is right out.
No.
So that is my colloquium on poisons.
Well, I liked it until you banned ice cream. I'm going to take issue.
Do you guys have any questions? That's not even all the poisons.
Yeah,
there are so many poisons.
I definitely have questions.
What should we do?
All right.
What are some good ways to keep yourself from encountering poison?
All right. Don't eat random mushrooms, for one thing. Basically, don't, like, go into the forest and think, that looks like a blueberry, I will eat that.
Oh, no.
Like, eat things that you recognize. Don't even, like, follow what the animals eat, necessarily, because some animals have absolutely no problem with, like, cattle and rabbits eat belladonna all the time. They don't seem to have any effect on them.
Wow.
That's
yeah.
so weird.
Only eat things you recognize when you are trying to survive in the wilderness.
I have a hint in that. I have heard, I'm fairly confident of this information. You know how, like, raspberries and that kind of thing, they look like berries, but they have, like, lots of little berries?
Yes.
Blackberries, raspberries. I have heard that there are no poisonous variations of berries that look like that shape, except one that is native only to Alaska and is white. So,
I would not put too much stock in that.
Oh, no. I'm going to poison myself trying to eat a blackberry.
I mean, it's possible, but people say a lot of things like that about mushrooms, too.
I guess. I've heard that, like, eating wild blackberries and stuff is fine.
Yeah, if you recognize it as a blackberry, if it looks like a blackberry and tastes like a blackberry, it's probably a blackberry.
Cool.
When you go to new places, be careful about water. Mm-hmm. There are often bacteria that your guts are not familiar with, and that's why drinking the water in a new place can make you sick.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they told us when we went to Russia.
Yeah, exactly. It's just unfamiliar bacteria. It's not necessarily that it's, like, evil water. It's just different water.
Right.
But if you grow up there, you're pretty much immune to it.
Well, yeah, your gut has gotten used to the bacteria, and it digests things just fine, so. As for, like, avoiding heavy metal poisons, we don't necessarily have too much of a problem with that here in the United States, although, you know, Flint is a notable exception. Communities like Flint that have water problems. And then there's things like acid mine runoff, where, like, you get iron hydroxide in a river and the whole river turns yellow. And it's called Yellow Boy, which is a hilarious name for a very terrible ecological disaster. So don't drink water that looks the wrong color.
I've always heard of poison referred to as, like, a woman's way of killing people type of thing in mystery stuff.
That's not true.
Cool.
It's just an
I was
easier
gonna say
way.
It's not true in general, but I didn't know if there was any history there. Like, fun
well,
stories.
I mean, the history is that people think that it's the easy way to kill someone, and therefore less honorable and less violent, and therefore only a woman would do it.
That's terrible.
Classically, more women have, like, famous murderers who are women have killed people with poison than with knives, but that is, you know, that is a physical strength sort of thing.
Right.
It's easier. It's not as hard to overpower someone. I would say, though, that, like, calling it a majority women's poison is blatantly untrue.
Okay. What is your favorite poison?
My favorite poison is thallium.
What is thallium?
Thallium is a very heavy metal, slightly radioactive. They used to use it as a pesticide. The fun thing about thallium is, there are a couple of fun things. The first one is that if you poison someone very slowly with thallium, it looks like they're suffering a bad bout of pneumonia.
Ooh.
Until their hair starts falling out.
That's not a pneumonia symptom.
That is not a pneumonia symptom.
How long after their hair falls out do they have?
Not very long. At that point, there is a lot of thallium in your body, and you don't... unless the poisoning stops completely, you will probably die, and even then, it'll take you a long, long time to recover.
Oof.
You will probably be weak for quite some time.
So what does thallium do? Does it stop you from absorbing something?
Thallium, I believe, ionizes as a +1, which makes me think that it takes the place of, sodium or potassium, and I don't know which one, and I'm afraid to make any determination there.
Okay.
Because Jesse will send us hate mail if we do.
Yeah, but not hate mail. Gentle correction mail. Or texts to my phone. Or peer-reviewed papers at my desk. The other reason I like thallium, though, is that the way that you test for it is you take a tissue sample, you grind it up, you treat it, and then you use a flame test.
You set it on fire?
Basically, yeah. You take a little bit of the solution and you set it on fire and see what color it is.
Ooh.
These flame tests give off various things, like copper is kind of a dark green. There are elements that flash red or blue. I'm sorry, copper is blue, not green. They flash yellow or you know, whatever.
So what
thallium
is
doing? Like a light spring green.
Ooh, pretty.
It's actually, that's what it is named after, is a goddess of the spring, is Thalia.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's so nice.
Yeah, so I like it. It's interesting. It's not very practical. You can't really get it anywhere anymore. It was common in the 20s as a pesticide, 20s and 30s. Not so much anymore. I mean, they use it for, like,
is it because
making
it's
electronics.
Very poisonous?
It is, in fact, because it's very poisonous.
That's what I thought.
Although the best... Okay, so if you want to get away with a murder, though...
Yes, please. I'm just kidding. I've been waiting for this part.
Try an uncommon alkaloid poison.
Okay.
Why are we giving this advice to people? This is so terrible.
We've already said don't try this at home.
Do you have a post-grad problem for us?
No, but I was debating on which of my many post-grad problems I should bring up. And there's a couple I'm encountering right now. One of them is more personal to my project, but one of them was one, and I thought, you know, I say this like it's funny, but it can actually be kind of serious, because I think the problem with this problem, the reason it's a problem, is because people don't talk about it, and so I want to talk about it. I have a confession to make.
Okay.
As a post-grad, and as someone who's currently working on a master's in philosophy, and already has one, a bachelor's in philosophy, and as someone in the humanities. I don't really like reading. Yeah. I know, right? But that's the thing. I've realized, it's not like I hate reading or anything like that, but I have a couple friends, like one of my friends who's in history, who just really enjoys reading. Like, the act of reading. Just enjoys her time. And I don't, it turns out. A lot of the time that I read stuff, even if it's very interesting stuff, I very much read it to get it done.
like, just with the purpose. And this has become a big problem for me, because it means I either read without learning, or just read too fast, or just put off reading and put off reading and put off reading because I just don't want to do it. Right now I'm struggling with, like, I have some stuff, and it's only, like, 30 pages, and all I have to do is read it and write a short summary of the conflict between these two pieces, and it's just, like, I just don't want to do it.
I'm kind of feeling you on that. Yeah. Not because I don't enjoy reading, but because I have not read in so long, it's like I've lost the knack. I tried to pick up a book the other day, and I kept wanting to look at my phone.
Yeah.
Isn't that the worst?
Well, I think I haven't helped it in that I haven't physically read for fun in some time because I opt towards audiobooks and podcasts, and I do a lot of audio media now. Audiobooks started for me because after reading all day for philosophy, my eyes were too tired to read for fun. I didn't want to put down my books and pick up another book because my eyes hurt. I have a lot of eyesight trouble. So that's how it started. And I think I've kind of reinforced it to the point where I don't ever read just for fun because there's so many good audiobooks out there. I say it's a confession because it feels like this is almost shameful, because it feels like part of the image that I have as someone who's doing a humanities degree. People just expect that of me, that I am a bookworm. And I do love literature. I would love to teach literature, but I don't super enjoy reading.
I don't think that there's anything wrong with that. Yeah. Like, I think our friend group especially tends toward bookwormery.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, most people don't love reading the way that most, like, I don't know.
Okay, but do most... Like I said, I think it's not... I feel in general like everyone should love reading. It's more, as someone who is currently doing a master's in Oxford in philosophy, it feels weird for me as someone in the humanities, that kind of stuff. But maybe I'm wrong in that, too.
Well, I would agree with you, except, you know, I tell people about the stories that I write, and they're like, why are you a chemist? And I'm like, well, I like that, too. Science is fun. Also, yeah. Job. Also, job.
Right?
What do you think about this, Cleo?
I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with the fact that you don't enjoy the actual act of reading. I love to read. You said our friend group tends towards bookwormery, and I tend towards book hoardery. I have literally stacks.
You're a bookworm with a Y. Like,
yeah, a I was about to say that.
Yep. I have just stacks of them. I love books, and I love reading physical books. And there's something very comforting for me about having books around.
Mm-hmm. Oh, same.
And it's almost like I get that. I do. Books are great. Libraries are great. I kind of get that affinity. But then I sit down to read, and my mind is just like, nope. Nope, not doing this. Not gonna. Hmm.
I mean, I struggle with that too, and I think some of it in undergrad for me, it was just I didn't have time. And so I wanted to read a lot of the books that I was reading for class.
Yeah.
But my frustration was that I ended up doing like you, I ended up reading them for a purpose, and so
yeah.
I was like, I would enjoy this book if I didn't have to read it, you know, in 2 days.
Yeah.
Right.
You couldn't savor it. All right. Here is, I think, a thing for discussion. Maybe.
Go ahead.
I don't love the act of reading so much as I like the download of information. Like, I don't love books as much as I love stories.
Yeah.
And I prize books because that's where the stories live.
And I mean,
if
I guess
a book is the most efficient way to get the story into my brain, then I will absolutely read it and I'll enjoy it. Love that. But I tried to read, it wasn't Jane Eyre, it was the other one, Wuthering Heights. I tried to read Wuthering Heights and I'm like, this is the opposite of efficient storytelling. I'm so bored.
I will say I'm not specifically referring to storybooks. I haven't read what I would call a storybook in quite some time.
mostly because, once again, I've gotten a lot of audiobooks and podcasts and things.
No, that's true, too. I've been reading so many scientific papers, I think I'm getting good at it, but I don't enjoy it.
Eventually, my sister and I will own all of the Terry Pratchett audiobooks on all of the Audible stores.
Nice.
But in any case, that's the problem I've run into lately. It surprised me about myself.
Ah. Cleo, you had a something to talk about that you are into this week, yes?
Yes, I do. Yeah, so this all started when someone sent me a link to an article about how Silicon Valley needs to get schooled. And
I'm sorry, who?
Silicon Valley.
Oh.
And so. Okay.
Oh, you sent us this article.
I did, and so.
Explain it, yeah.
Basically, the premise is that today people are kind of under the spell of technology to the point that they think that science and algorithms can answer every question we have about life.
That's not true.
I have encountered this.
Science here, it's not true.
Philosophy here, it's definitely not true.
Can you prove it? The title of the book is called Sense Making.
Okay. Sense Making. I like that. It's a good title.
Is that one word?
Yes. Sense Making.
I love it.
The Power of the Humanities in the Age of the Algorithm by Christian Madsbjerg.
How do you spell that, Cleo?
M-A-D-S-B-J-E-R-G.
Oh, Madsbjerg.
Yes. That's what I said.
Nice. I'm going to sit here and not attempt a pronunciation of that word.
Anyway, he is a philosopher who has a consulting business, and he takes his consulting business and goes into companies and helps them basically do what they need to do with the skills that he's learned from the humanities. So, for example, he talks about how algorithms can't teach you about culture. They can't teach you about the rich layers of human culture and human experience. It requires a different set of mental skills and really emotional intuitiveness. A lot of the reason that we feel overwhelmed in modern life is because we think that algorithms and Google can tell us everything there is to know.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you know, life isn't really any more complicated than it's ever been. We just are under the impression that we have the ability to solve it.
Ooh, and I like that.
So
that's very good.
When in reality, and at the end of the day, there are things that only people can do, and one of those is care. He has this whole last section of the book, and his point is that, you know, people are for caring.
I feel like there's a really good metaphor for, like, Sherlock Holmes and John Watson here, or, like, Spock and Bones, or, you know.
It's a really good book. I've really enjoyed it.
It sounds good.
And you can get it on Audible.
Yes! That means I can do it!
Well, I guess that about wraps it up for us, huh?
Yep.
Next week, I'll be back with more Joan of Arc.
Fantastic. Thanks to Tristan at Vintage Lab Tech for our theme song and closing song. Thank you guys for podcasting with me. If you'd like to contact us, you can do that at theliberalarts@gmail.com or on our website, theliberalarts.com, or on our Facebook page, which is probably the best way to contact us. That's what we check most often.
I wanted to thank Caitlin Thompson, who's the person who did our logo and all of the art that is associated with the liberal arts.
Absolutely.
Amazing.
Thank you.
And I love it. My first sister's first reaction on seeing the logo was, "Is that Comic Sans?" But you know what? Like,
yes.
It still looks good.
It's so good.
So thank you, Caitlin. You've done a lot of volunteer work and helping us make this better. So
for sure.
We love you.
Join us next week for more. And until next time, learn something worth knowing.